The Daily Buzz, a new podcast from the Salt Lake Tribune.
Every weekday, The Daily Buzz will share the day's biggest news from across Utah, explained by the Tribune journalists that reported it.
We'll cover everything from bills Utah's lawmakers are debating to how the Beehive State's healthcare providers are responding to the ongoing coronavirus pandemic.
In the time it takes you to drink your morning coffee, The Daily Buzz will get you ready for your day in just 5 to 7 minutes.
For more than 150 years, the Salt Lake Tribune has delivered the daily news to Utahns. And now we can't wait to share our mornings with you.
Join us.
Thanks for joining us today on Mormon Land, where we explore news in and about the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I'm managing editor Dave Noyce. I oversee the Salt Lake Tribune's faith coverage. I'm joined again by senior religion reporter Peggy Fletcher-Stack. Hello, Peggy.
Hi, Dave.
We remind our listeners about another way to support Mormon Land. Just go to patreon.com, where with a small donation, you can access transcripts to our podcasts, our complete newsletter, and other gifts. Again, that's Patreon, patreon.com/Mormon Land. Now for today's show. The world today is more divided than ever on political solutions to seemingly intractable problems. And sadly, some rifts have seeped into the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Many members have entrenched themselves in their own partisan positions, choosing derision over dialogue by refusing to talk or even listen to other viewpoints. Others have chosen to eschew politics altogether, believing it is impossible for policymakers to get anything right, and that politics has no place with faith. Retired federal judge Thomas Griffith, a Latter-day Saint convert who stepped down from the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit in 2020, argues just the opposite, that politics is indeed, in his words, a religious activity. He joins us today via Zoom from Virginia to discuss how to practice politics without, quote, losing your soul. Judge Griffith, welcome.
Thank you.
Glad to have you with us. So, how did you get immersed in politics yourself?
Yeah, well, I grew up in the Washington, D.C. area. My father worked for the federal government, and my mother was a realtor in McLean, Virginia, which is a suburb that shares a border with Washington, D.C. I went to public schools in McLean, and I went to school with the sons and daughters of congressmen, senators, Supreme Court justices, and people who worked for the federal government. There's nothing unusual about that. They were plentiful in those days. So I grew up immersed in the political world of Washington, D.C.
When did you convert to Mormonism?
I was a junior in high school in 1971 when I became a Latter-day Saint.
Okay. So let's jump to the topic now, since we've got that set up. Why do you believe that politics is a religious practice?
Well, I think properly understood, I think the goal of religion is to bring people together. It's atonement, at-one-ment, and religion is to unite the individual with God, and then to unite the individual with others. Theologians will call it the vertical pull of the atonement, which is to bring us to God, and the horizontal pull, which is to bring us to others. And when you're going to unite with others, you're going to form community. And the way communities run is through politics, I think properly understood. So I think if the goal of a believer, especially a Christian, especially a Latter-day Saint Christian, is to bring people together into community, that necessarily involves politics.
What about yearning for justice? You've talked about that.
Oh, yeah. So years ago, I remember reading a talk by N.T. Wright, who's an Anglican cleric and a biblical scholar. I think I first heard of N.T. Wright. Elder Holland referenced him in a general conference address. I'd never heard of them. I was embarrassed to say I'd never heard of N.T. Wright, but I went and started read some of his works. And he wrote a defense of Christianity that tries to take the place, I think, of C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity. And when Wright is arguing for the existence of God, the first argument he relies upon is that humans have a sense of justice. And that really struck me. I thought as I read that, ooh, does that describe my religious imperative? Is that what's at the core of who I am? But I think Wright is correct. I think properly understood. Justice, yearning to help form community, yearning to help those, particularly those on the margins, is a religious impulse. Now, you don't have to be a religious person to have a yearning for justice. But I think if you are a religious person without a yearning for justice, you might want to do some introspection. There may be something deficient in your discipleship. There certainly was in mine. That theme really struck a chord with me.
So, what are the dangers of politics to spirituality?
Well, that's kind of obvious, isn't it? I mean, because first of all, when I'm certain your listeners, when they hear that you have somebody on who's saying politics is a religious activity, they'll either think that he's a complete extremist who uses his religion to rally his partisan views. You know, God is on my side and you're wrong. Or he'll think that I'm completely naive about it, because politics, as we see it practiced, doesn't seem to be much of a religious activity. But so I'm obviously evangelizing here. I'm preaching as to something that can be done and sometimes is done. I mean, you know, the greatest example that comes to my mind is look at the American Civil Rights Movement. That was politics that created a larger and more inclusive and better sense of community founded on justice. And it shouldn't be a surprise to any to realize that it was Dr. King's commitment to Christianity and to his colleagues that drove the American Civil Rights Movement. So there's an example of politics being done well. Unfortunately, we live in a time when people are using politics too often to divide. And that's why people are surprised when you say politics can be a religious activity, because it doesn't seem to be used that way by too many of our politicians today.
So the danger is what? The danger to a soul by being engaged in politics.
Well, yeah, I think if one thinks that God is on your side and you're in a battle for Armageddon, I think that's very dangerous, because that's going to lead to divisiveness, and that's an anti-atonement use of politics. Yeah. But as we see, that's a very easy error to slip into. The easiest thing in the world is for me to think that God endorses my views on marginal tax rates. You know, I mean, that's just an easy thing for people to slip into. But it's dangerous. It's dangerous. So it's a dangerous activity to be involved in, but I think it's an absolutely necessary one. Look, for Latter-day Saints, when you look back at the earliest days of the Restoration, the model that inspired them was Enoch's people. Right? Joseph Smith receives this revelation about this biblical prophet Enoch and what he was able to accomplish. And he built a city where they were of one heart, and one mind, dwelt in righteousness, and there was no poor among them. And that was the goal. If you were a Latter-day Saint in 1831 and someone were to ask you what your beliefs were, that would be it. We're here to build this sort of Zion community. I think it's really significant that story is about a city. A city requires law, right? And a city requires politics. But there we have politics being used to unite and not divide. So I think it's deep. It's deep in the soul of the Restoration. Unfortunately, this day it's not being practiced too much by too many of us, but we can do better.
Judge, you bring up an interesting point that I wanted to explore with you. You've alluded to it now a little bit. We often hear partisans on all sides of the spectrum. They'll cite scripture or religious principles found in Mormonism, for instance, as reasons for their political allegiances. In other words, to put it in a partisan frame, I'm a Democrat because of, and then they'll cite these things. I'm a Republican because of, or whatever the political persuasion might be. You've said that you're uncomfortable with that kind of talk. Why is that?
Well, I don't doubt that someone's political views are shaped by their religious views. And there's nothing wrong with that. I would just like to see some more humility about that. I became a judge, and so I'm no longer a partisan. I've left the partisan world behind. But before I was a judge, I was a partisan. I was deeply involved in Republican Party politics and was a conservative for many years, had strongly held views. And I'm not saying that I'm the model in this one, but you know, during those years, the thought never crossed my mind that my views on public policy matters would be the Lord's. No, I don't know what his views are on marginal tax rate. I do know his views on something, and that's very significant. And we get that in Matthew 25 and in some restoration scriptures. He cares a great deal about how a society takes care of those on the margins, right? Now, that he cares a great deal about. Now, how we go about doing that, I don't know. I mean, my progressive friends have a certain vision for how you go about doing that. And my conservative friends have a different vision. As long as we're all united on the goal that that's our charge, is to build and create a just society that cares for those on the margins, I'm okay with that. Then we'll argue and debate about the best way to accomplish that. So I'm not saying that religious views shouldn't inform your politics. Indeed, we said at the outset, the sense of justice ought to be a religious imperative that gets us involved. But when we're in that field, when we're in the political field, I think the imperative for Latter-day Saints, and I'll cite President Oaks on this one, we're supposed to be acting in a different way than politics is normally performed. And it was at last April's General Conference where President Oaks said that this is going to be pretty close to a quote, on contested issues, we seek to moderate and to unify. Now, that is a different view of politics than is practiced by many, many people in America at this moment right now. And I shouldn't speak for President Oaks, but that sure sounded authoritative to me. You know, I mean, that sounded like he was telling us this is how we do it. And so I think the question for believing Latter-day Saints is that how I'm doing it? On contested issues, am I seeking to moderate and to unify, or am I seeking to cancel and obliterate and to humiliate and defeat and to own the libs or own the, or whatever, you know, mm-hmm. own it. So I think Christians in general, Latter-day Saints in particular, have an obligation to do politics in different ways.
So how should members on either side treat their political opponents?
Well, that's an easy one, right? They should treat them with respect and dignity. Latter-day Saints believe that every person on the earth is a literal son or daughter of heavenly parents, right? That fact alone ought to change the way we interact with others, including our political opponents. So, and I think, you know, there's, maybe this may seem a bit hubristic here, but I think Latter-day Saints have a special obligation in this area. And I think we're actually uniquely qualified to make a positive contribution here, because if there's one thing that we're pretty good at, and a lot of things we're not so good at, but if there's one thing we're pretty good at, it's building community, right? We're pretty good at that. Now, we're not perfect at it. We're pretty good at that. I once heard Richard Bushman say in a private conversation, but he's given me permission to repeat this, that of all the things that Latter-day Saints have to offer the world, he thinks that the greatest is our understanding of how to build community. And I couldn't agree more. And so that sort of idealistic challenge is that we take the lessons we learn from our community building in our wards, and we take them outside the chapel and we start to practice them in our community. And that we be the ones, I mean, wouldn't it, you know, here's my real pie in the sky idea. You know, my dream is that, you know, 20, 25 years from now, people will say, I mean, right now they say, oh, you're Latter-day Saints. Oh, you're polygamous. You know, you don't drink, you don't smoke or something, nothing like that. Or you take care of your families and that's fine. But wouldn't it be great if they'd say, oh, Latter-day Saints. Oh, you're the people that build bridges between folks, right? You're the reconciliation people, right? That's what you're about. It's clearly what President Nelson is telling us to do, but we've got a long way to go.
Have you seen any examples in your life of people reaching across the aisle to, like you're suggesting?
Oh yeah. It used to be the norm in politics. It was not at all uncommon. And let's be clear. A lot of that still happens today. I mean, there's a lot, let's take Congress. There's a lot of legislation in Congress that doesn't get covered particularly well by the media where, you know, you have people reaching across the aisle to do it. But there's a lot that's not. A couple of years ago, and look, the members of Congress know this is a problem. A couple of years ago, they tried to address it by at the State of the Union address. They announced they called it date night. And the idea was that if you were going to go to the State of the Union address, you needed to sit with someone from across the aisle and sit together. And that was a very nice gesture, but not a whole lot came of it. But it's a nice gesture. So some of that does happen, but not enough. And what we see instead is the politics of personal destruction, the politics of division, the politics that lacks compromise. And that's a change. That's a change. And my point is, I don't think that's a good change.
Well, have you seen the political climate grow more divisive in the era of Donald Trump and COVID-19?
Well, I wouldn't attribute it just to those factors. There's plenty of blame to throw around here. Mrs. Clinton's calling people deplorables. That was not an act of reconciliation, right? Right. And President Obama, for whom I have a great deal of admiration, when he belittled his opponents as, you know, they got their guns and their religion and they're afraid. That's the type of language that doesn't help. It doesn't help. It certainly seems to have gotten worse during the pandemic. Who would have thought that a public health issue would be turned into partisan? For partisan purposes, that's not a good sign of where we are on this idea of using politics to build bridges.
Judge Griffith, as these divisions seem to start infecting, if I can choose that verb, the church's membership as well, are you worried about Latter-day Saints losing their sense of community?
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. I was at a gathering in the last year with Elder Lance Wickman. He's an emeritus General Authority 70, but is still the general counsel for the church and actively involved in that role. And he made an observation. It was a private meeting, but he he's given me permission and actually encouraged me to share this wherever I could. We were discussing this very issue, like, what is going on? We've got, wards and stakes that people are divided over their politics and over whether they wear masks or not. And it's not a healthy thing. We were in this extended discussion, and Elder Wickman summed it up, I thought, best when he said, too many of our people have traded their religion for their politics. And I thought he just nailed that one, that too many of us, it seems that our primary allegiance is to our political party. And in the meantime, our commitment to building Zion in our wards is suffered. If I can sound like a theologian for and not a judge for a second, in John chapter 17, there's some scriptures that as a missionary, I use a great deal to talk about the nature of the Godhead. It's where Jesus is praying for his disciples. And he prays to the Father that his disciples may be one as he and the Father are one. We always use that to talk about the nature of the Trinity, the nature of the Godhead, and distinctive approach that Latter-day Saints have to that topic. But that's kind of missing the whole point. I went back. You read the scriptures, kind of miss. Yeah, that's there. But the whole point of that statement from Jesus, if you keep reading, he says that he's praying for their unity, so that the world may know that thou, the Father, has sent me. Now, again, I'm not a theologian here. I'm not a biblical scholar. That sure sounds to me like Jesus is saying the primary way you can bear witness of Christ to the world is unity in the church. I think that's true. I think that's true. And we're falling short of that at this moment right now. And I think it's a serious, significant problem. We certainly hear about it at the general conference that it's a problem, right? And in my experience where I live and talking to friends around the country in different areas, seems to be a significant problem that wards and stakes are dividing along political lines.
So switching topics a little bit, is there a Mormon approach to judging?
No, no, there's not. So at least if there is, I never discovered it. I mean, no, when you take the oath of office to be a judge, your oath is to the Constitution and the laws of the United States. And that's your primary obligation. I would get asked a similar question frequently when I would meet with Latter-day Saints students, where they would say, "So how does your religion, how does your faith affect your job as a judge?" And my maybe too cute answer was, "Well, if I'm doing my job really right, it has no effect at all, except in the sense that no, you want to do a good job, right? Yeah." I've taken an oath, and so my faith tells me, keep the oath. And the oath is, no, there isn't a Mormon way of judging.
None of that yearning for justice kind of comes in there?
Well, it does in the following sense. If the American people have decided what their sense of justice is through law, and they put it in the Constitution, or their elected representatives put it in acts of Congress, yeah, that's what you do. My view of a judge is that you are a faithful agent of we the people as they express their values through the Constitution and through acts of Congress. And so that's my charge. I wasn't given an invitation to decide questions by my finely thought through concept of what's right and wrong, fair and right, and just. That's not what I was asked to do. That's up for the elected representatives of the people.
I'd like to go back to President Oakes for a second, but talk about another speech he gave in the last year at the University of Virginia. And I know you're familiar with that one.
You were
probably there. I think I saw a picture of you there. Yeah. Of course, himself, a former judge, a Utah Supreme Court justice. And he basically called out for something you've already referenced to a little bit, seeking middle ground, seeking middle way, compromise. He earned much praise for that, but also some criticism for some who feel like you can't sometimes bend on some things. Mm-hmm. What's your view of that? What do you think?
Well, so can I step back even further? So I'm trying to think what year it was. Was it 2014, 2015, something along in that time frame, where he gave a similar speech that was reported on the front page of the New York Times. He was out in Sacramento, California, and spoke to a group. I think it was a group of judges and ministers or something. It's an unusual gathering. And I remember a colleague of mine on the D.C. Circuit first drew the article to my attention. And I can remember reading the article and reading the speech. And in that, then Elder Oakes sort of said, let's stop talking about culture wars. We're not warriors. These are our fellow citizens. And I got to tell you, Dave, that was a big moment for me. It really hit me. I thought, oh, that's right. No, that's what we're supposed to be different, right? And ever since then, from what I can tell, Elder Oakes, now President Oakes, has been sounding that theme, that we're not warriors. We're the people that are looking for ways to compromise. Now, clearly, I don't like the word clearly, but anyway, in my view, clearly, there's some things that you can't compromise on, right? I mean, there's some things you can't compromise on. I think, I shouldn't speak for President Oakes, but the way I interpret what he's saying is the things you can't compromise on are probably a much smaller universe than you think. So find ways to compromise as much as you can without breaking, right? Now, that's a tough exercise. But what it entails, at the very least, is that as a citizen, if I'm looking to build community, I'm looking for ways to make you feel at home, right? And I'm actually willing to give up some of the things that make me feel at home so that you can feel at home. And I'm making a bet, right? It's a gamble. And the bet is, if I do that, you know what? You might do the same for me. That you enter, you introduce into the dynamic really a sense of charity and goodness and compromise. Now, this very real question, whether we can pull that off, whether this country is so divided that it can't happen. But there is a historical precedent, and I think it's an instructive one. If you go back to the Constitutional Convention in 1787, you know, we call it the Miracle at Philadelphia for good reason. Something remarkable happened there. The convention was deadlocked, about to dissolve because they couldn't decide how the big states and the small states work together. That was in July of 1787. They compromised and they created a constitution. George Washington, in the letter transmitting it to the Continental Congress, described it as the product of the spirit of amity and mutual deference, which the peculiarity of our circumstances rendered indispensable. The spirit of amity and mutual deference. What does that mean? Well, there's a lot that it means, but here's one thing it means. At a critical moment in the convention, when things weren't going well, a group of moderates, 11 moderates, gathered together at Benjamin Franklin's home, and they decided they were going to come up with a compromise to create a union, even though they didn't know the terms of the compromise. And so the first step in success was that those delegates decided, we're going to create a union. We're going to compromise, even though we don't know terms of the compromise. I don't want to make too much of that moment, but I actually think that that's the insight. When people say, I want to support and defend the Constitution, and, you know, they pull out their pocket copy of the Constitution and they say it's all about guns and, you know, and the Second Amendment. I think, hey, the Second Amendment's there. I've written some opinions that that uphold the right of an individual to bear arms. I was the poster judge for the NRA for a while. Not something I ever sought, but I've ruled that way on the Second Amendment. But that is not the con. I mean, the Constitution is about a little bit more than the Second Amendment. The Constitution is about a little bit more than religious liberty, even though that means a great deal to me. If you want to support and defend the Constitution, if you really want to, then you need to be like the people in 1787. They created a union, and they did so by compromise. Union was the most important thing for them. So if we want to support and defend the Constitution, we need to be the people who build bridges of understanding. That's how you really support and defend the Constitution. And that's where it is in most in peril right now. This is not a good moment. Jonathan Haidt, the social psychologist who wrote The Righteous Mind and some other great works, was interviewed a couple years ago, and I'll have to paraphrase him, but he predicted a cataclysmic failure of American democracy in the near future because, he said, we just don't know what happens to a democracy when you drain all trust out of the system. And that's what's happening right now, right? We're seeing trust drained out of the system. So you want to support and defend the Constitution? Let's put some trust back in the system because it's a trustworthy system. Our election system works really well. And if you're somebody out there who's claiming that the election system is broken and fraudulent, first of all, that's not true. It's demonstrably not true. And second, when you say that, you are undermining people's faith and confidence and trust in our democracy. And that will have, is having, and will continue to have dire consequences.
I was struck by something you just said, going back to the Grand Compromise in the forming of the nation, that they decided they were going to compromise before they even knew what the compromise was. It struck me, that's a big leap of faith in its own right, right there. I wonder how much negotiation like that ever happens now, where people go in knowing they're going to compromise, knowing what it's going to be.
Let me add something to that. And I'm basing this on the scholarship of a young scholar named Derek Webb, who wrote a really important piece a number of years ago called The Original Meaning of Civility, something like Democratic Compromise at the Constitutional Convention, something like that. And Webb explores this very issue. So how could they do that? How could they make that leap of faith? How could they say, we're going to compromise before we knew the terms of the compromise? And Webb's exploration, he comes up with some really interesting ideas. And one is they're in Philadelphia, not many of them. There wasn't a lot of boarding available. So they ended up sleeping in the same room, right? You know, they sleeping in the same bed, you know, and they got to know each other really well in close quarters. They worked every day in the convention from 10 till 3 or 4 in the afternoon, Monday through Saturday. And then they'd go have dinner together in dinner groups. They formed dinner groups together. And it wasn't along party lines or regional lines. George Mason wrote to his son that, and I have to paraphrase this, but something like, you know, as a result of all this socializing, we got to be friends with one another. And then at key moments during the summer, Benjamin Franklin would open his home and have a grand party where the libations flowed, and they got to know each other really well. So Webb's idea, and I like this idea, is the reason they were able to take that leap of faith and compromise was because they had genuine affection one for another, and they trusted one for another. And in this regard, I'm going to give a shout out to now Elder Matthew Holland, but it was then Matt Holland's PhD dissertation that was published by Georgetown, which is a fabulous book. It's called Bonds of Affection, Civic Charity and the Founding of America. And Elder Matt Holland traces this idea of the bonds of affection through American history. Now, we all know the moments when there were no bonds of affection, but it's part of the American DNA to talk about and to try and strengthen bonds of affection. And obviously, that phrase comes from our greatest president's first inaugural address, where he invoked the bonds of affection to try and keep the Union together, and he failed, right? But anyway, that to me, that's it. That's the politics of atonement. That's the politics that we ought to be engaged in, a politics based on genuine bonds of affection, even though we have different views about fundamental things. I mean, it sounds so Sunday schoolish. It just sounds so naive, but I really believe it. I really believe it's true. This is what Arthur Brooks is doing these days, right? I mean, this is I'm taking a page out of Arthur Brooks's playbook, where Brooks says, "Yeah, civility, that's a good thing, but if I were to tell you that my wife and I were civil to one another, you would tell us get some counseling, right?" Now, there's got to be more than civility. There has to be genuine
bonds of affection.
And I think we can do it. We ought to be the people doing that.
Yeah. More cots in Congress. That's what it's going to take, right?
I didn't hear that.
More cots, as in sleeping together, all together in the same room.
No, I'm not saying that. I tell you what, one thing it does take, though. So when I was growing up, I mentioned lots of congressmen and senators lived in the Washington area. Like, none of them live there now. And one of the reasons for that is because the American people go nuts when they vote themselves a pay raise. Well, on their salaries, they really can't afford to buy a home in the Washington, D.C. area and maintain a home back in Indiana. And if they had enough money to do it, they buy a place in D.C., they get primaried in Indiana because they've gone, you know, native sort of thing. So as a result of it, and you know this, the typical member of Congress will fly into Washington Tuesday morning. They'll have their sessions Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, and then Thursday afternoon they leave and fly back to Oklahoma. They don't know one another. I was at a lunch with a senator a couple of years ago who was talking about this, and he said the only time he interacts with people from across the aisle is in the gym and at Bible study. He said, but other than that, he said, I don't know them. And that's a real problem. But that's actually something that we have contributed to by our refusing to allow themselves pay raise so they can afford to live there. So they can go to soccer games together and meet each other with their kids and go to churches together and PTAs and stuff. That just doesn't happen at all anymore.
I was just going to say, bring it back to Latter-day Saints. I mean, one of the strengths of the LDS Church is organizing by neighborhood, not along party lines, not among liberal conservative. And so people are worshiping together from opposite political perspectives, which is why it's kind of troubling that there's become divisions in wards, but it's still a strength of the system along with what you're talking about.
I think it's one of the geniuses of the system. And this is Eugene England, right? Why the church is as true as the gospel. It's not a bug of the system, although it makes it hard. I mean, you know, it'd be a lot easier to go to church with people who agree with me on everything, but I don't. And so that forces them to stretch. But, you know, as you work with somebody side by side in the primary or in young men or young women, you know, if you're on a trek with them, you find out that even though they have crazy political views and music you don't like, you discover something very profound. And that is the Lord loves them every bit as much as he loves you. And that is the beginning of wisdom, right? Yeah, no, I agree with you. We do that really well. So that's one of the things I think since we know how to do that, you know, this is Richard's radiant Mormonism idea. We need to take that knowledge and experience we have and get it outside the foyer and get it in the community.
Well, Judge Thomas Griffith, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
And thanks to Peggy Fletcher Stack.
Always a pleasure.
And our producer, Chris Samuels. We remind our listeners that they can keep up on all the happenings in and about the church by subscribing to the Salt Lake Tribune's free Mormon Land newsletter. Just go to sltrib.com to sign up, and we'll talk again next time on Mormon Land.